call the House Transportation meeting to order and let the record show that today we're having a joint meeting with the Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism Committee. And so it was, our meeting is convened at about 7 minutes after 1:00. And the following House presence, or House members are present: Representative Lynn, Representative Gaddis, Vice Chair Representative Isaacson, and myself, Representative Wilson. And Representative Hughes, is there anyone else from your committee going to be coming down that you know of?
Well, we'll double dip with Representative Gaddis is on my committee, and we may have one or two others join us. We're, okay. We're not sure.
All righty. So I would like to recognize the staff then today. Nancy Hemingway is our House Recording Secretary over here, and Sam is our LIO monitor over there, and my committee aide is Becky Rooney, and the EDT committee aide is Ginger
Blaisdell.
So before we start, please turn off, if you have your cell phones with you, please turn them off or at least put them on airplane mode. And we'll be hearing about a mode of transportation today that has been around a long time. However, and I'm excited to hear about it because I don't know too much about it, but it's a new inventive application of the airship technology. And so today we're going to see how it applies to transportation of goods and people. So we've scheduled an hour for this presentation, and then we will adjourn and then reconvene to have our regular committee meeting afterwards. And we have a bill in that committee, and it's Bill 271, and we'll be hearing that later. So Curtis Zell, is he going to be presenting? Okay. So we'll go ahead and let you do the presentation, and we will learn all these exciting things. Okay, and they're online? Okay. Curtis, can you hear us?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. We can hear you fine. Introduce
yourself. Okay, great. I think there might have been a mix-up, Chairwoman. Michael Smith is actually presenting.
Okay. That's
just so you know.
Michael Smith, okay. And he's also with the same organization.
Same company.
Okay.
Yes, so. Yes, good afternoon. This is Michael Smith. I'm the chairman of Skylift Aeronautics. Good afternoon, committee members. It's great to be presenting today. I'd like to let you know that obviously a very thorough presentation would take hours, but due to time constraints, we're going to try and compress this and give you as much of an impact regarding the airship as we possibly can. I believe that you have gotten a supplemental to the presentation package, which we sent out, so that it gives you the specifications of the airship. So if there's any questions on those, please feel free to ask me at any time. So with further ado, I will go ahead and start my presentation.
Please do.
Skylift Aeronautics was formed back in 2012 to become the exclusive marketing, sales, and leasing representative for Lockheed Martin's hybrid aircraft. So if anyone would like to purchase an aircraft, they would have to go through Skylift Aeronautics. The beauty of this airship is that it is going to transform so many different aspects of the way we do business on the planet that this is a game changer. The benefits to Alaska, we'll go to the first page. The economic growth, it'll lower operating costs versus any fixed-wing transport, more productivity, create new jobs, much safer transportation, expanded commerce, both domestic and international, and cleaner environment.
And I'm anxious to see. How it's going to be safer than what we do now.
Well, let me explain the construction. I'm sorry?
You don't have to explain it right now. I'm just anxious to see as you move through it how that's going to happen.
Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, very good. So very quickly, the economics and what it can do for Alaska. There's a lot of interior mining going on in Alaska, so mining would be a very depictive scenario for the airships. The infrastructure, the roads, the power, everything else that it takes to get from civilization to an outbound would cost billions, hundreds of millions, if not billions. With the airship, the capabilities are vertical loft, straight across, drop down. It only needs a flat area to land. So therefore, if you have the size of a football field, this aircraft can drop in. This would actually save a lot of time, effort, and needless expense going in and out of the mining regions. So the payloads coming out and payloads going in would really reduce the cost of any type of infrastructure. Alternative shipping. The fuel that it would cost to ship throughout the channels, the airship can go point to point. You load, you fly, and you drop down. Very simple. Oil and gas. The ability to transport various types of fuel, liquid fuel, LNG fuel, LNG gas rather. It can fly to oil platforms. It can fly to regions where there's oil rigs. Very simply put, it can do a number of things that fixed wings cannot do. Alternative transportation. For example, the iceberg, the Dalton Highway. Year-round, you can fly the airship up and back. It can fly in as low as 40 degree temperatures and as high as 122 degree temperatures. So the safety of that is you don't have to worry about your payload going through the ice at any point in time. It can fly up, drop the payload, come back, just like it would in a mining scenario. And also, at this point in time, it is not rated for passenger boating. However, within a year and a half to 2 years, it will be certified by the FAA for people transportation. This means that you, instead of taking buses or ferries, et cetera, this would be an alternative to those types of transport as well. Surveillance and mapping, self-explanatory. But one of the other major issues would be on-the-spot medical response. The airship is so stable that it can carry an operating room on board. So it can fly into any disaster area and or respond to any medical need and perform any type of operation, medical operation that is required.
Okay.
So in other words, if there is somebody out on an island and it's a life or death situation, there's only so much time. If you fly the airship out, you can do the procedure right there instead of flying an aircraft out, flying it back, getting them prepped.
Michael?
Yes.
As we go along, would you rather us wait to ask questions, or would you like us to ask questions as we go along?
I think as you need, we can take questions on the fly. It may be better. I'm kind of ripping through this quite quickly, and unfortunately, I can't see you on my monitor for some reason, so I can't see anybody raising their hand. So just do a shout out and I'll stop and answer the question.
Okay, and right now Representative Lynn has a question.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for your presentation. What are the crosswinds restrictions on this thing. You have huge flat sides on it, and it, you know, crosswinds of course affect all airplanes. This is an airship, but it seemed to me to be very difficult for an airship, and I see a picture of it here, to deal with any kind of serious crosswind, particularly landing and taking off.
Yeah, depending on the type of crosswinds, this is capable of handling up to 45 knot crosswinds. So the aerodynamics of this is quite effective. And the other solution to that problem is that it has fly-by-wire, which means that they took the navigational system and the drive system out of the F-35, and that's what is used to pilot this particular airship. So it has the ability to compensate, and although it looks like it's quite huge and it would be blown away, through their actual tests, and when I mean actual tests, they've actually done their third-scale model and had it sitting in 40-knot winds, and it did not move because of the aerodynamics.
How fast can one go?
Well, there's three variants, which is 25-ton, the 100-ton, and the 500-ton for simplicity. The 25-ton actually does 60 knots.
Pardon?
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
How much is that in miles per hour?
60 knots equates to about 90 miles an hour.
All right.
And then the mid-size ship actually it does 80, and then the larger ship is capable of 120.
Those are knots. Okay, thank you. Go ahead. I don't see any other questions.
Okay.
One more question. Representative
Hughes
has one.
I just wanted to clarify. I had the privilege of hearing Michael and Curtis's presentation yesterday. Just to clarify, the temperature range in which the airship can fly, I think you may have forgotten to say negative 40, so 40 below, and they actually do well in cold temperatures. So I just want to make sure that we didn't think that 40 degrees to 100 is minus.
That is correct. Yes, a negative 40 degrees, and actually the colder, the better they fly. You're absolutely right.
So they would do much better in Alaska than they do in the lower 48?
I believe so. That's why the majority of our initial flights are going to be in Alaska. So
all right.
It's going to get the biggest test there.
So.
We hope.
Representative Gaddis has a question.
Okay.
Thank you. And for those that have fixed-wing airplanes and fly fixed-wing airplanes, I suspect Representative Lynn and myself, Representative Lynn Gaddis, not to be confused, will probably have a lot of aviation questions. So if you'll bear with us, I'm sure that as we go along. So what I'm hearing you say is that because of our I certainly understand where there might be tests over in the Colorado area. I see where there's tests in Alaska. But is Alaska, are you doing the test for the temperature specifically in the winter? Or quite frankly, are you doing it because we're a big state and there's less population and you can do the test a little bit more freely?
It's just a question of what we'd like to do is the very first year that we put these out, we actually want to see how well they do in cold temperatures. So that could be anywhere across Canada, but instead of going out of country, we would much rather stay in country and go to Alaska and utilize the craft there. to gather our information.
Thank you. So what I'm really trying to say is a cold I'm sorry. It's a cold temperature test.
Definitely would be a cold temperature test.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Hughes has a question.
Yeah, I actually have a comment, just because I think it would help us as we move through, just to clarify, and I think Michael kind of mentioned it, but just so folks are aware, there is a smaller version that is now in a Lockheed hangar, correct? And you're looking to be signing an agreement April 1st with Lockheed, and we'll be building, I believe, the 25-ton, with hopes that it'll be ready for flight by next February, and so sometimes next year you will be bringing that up from, is it from California to Anchorage?
Correct.
Okay.
Palmdale, California, up to Anchorage, yes.
Okay, so I thought that would be helpful for people to realize that's kind of where we are in the phases of this new tech. Well, some of it's old technology, and at some point you don't have to do it right now, but I think talk to us a little bit why we aren't looking. Many of us think of the Hindenburg disaster when we think of blimps and airships and things like that, so you could at some point address why this is a safer version, as Representative Wilson brought up, the difference between hydrogen and helium and all those good things.
Absolutely. So finishing up on economics, the tourism industry, once it becomes passenger rated, then the ability there is that it would be, Alaska is a very beautiful state. So the only way that you can see the majority of it is either by fast-moving plane or by cruise ship. Now, with the airship, the capacity is quite random. I mean, for example, in your handout, you can see the passenger seating, for example, on a 20-ton is only 8 passengers, but if you were to go ahead and turn the cargo compartment, you could definitely do up to about 100 passengers. And the larger you go, the more passengers it can hold. And you can run through that. It's probably easier for you to look through that handout than it is for me to try and explain. However, because it's such, it can be adapted to a passenger airship, you'd have windows, and the slow-moving flight would definitely be a very good tourist attraction, taking them all over. I know we have requests from some people in Las Vegas that actually want 100-ton, which is the medium size, and the reason that they want that is they want to put a flying restaurant in it and fly out around the Grand Canyon and, you know, over the city. Interesting concept, but if you can think of something to do with these airships, it's everything is possible, almost everything.
Okay, now, Mike.
Go ahead.
So right now, you don't have any of them tooling around the United States or anything. You're in the process of developing them, and you're kind of doing some beta testing in Alaska, maybe? Is that what?
Correct.
Possibly? Okay. And Representative Hughes has a comment.
Yes, just because you're talking about the passenger aspect, the largest model, tell us how many passengers that would hold. I was quite impressed with that yesterday.
I believe that's up to 2,800 people, and that's a 500-ton aircraft. And when we talk about 2,800, that would be a double deck. So you'd have 1,200 on one deck and 1,200 on another, plus or minus, plus your crew.
So
you've got a double-decker, and they both have, it has windows on all sides.
So are these going to be cheap enough so that some tourism industry could buy one and have a business, or are they going to be so expensive that they're going to be out of reach? I mean, what are we talking about here?
When we talk practicality here, if you were going to use one of these as a tourist vehicle, I would probably stay in the range of the small to medium. I don't think that taking 2,800 passengers around would be, unless you're charging, a great deal of money. On a cursory, we're talking the small being about $45 million, the medium being about $83 million, and then the large being around $273 million. Okay. So economically, that would definitely have to be up to the charging of, the fare for riding, et cetera. It'd be just like a cruise ship or whatever. And we haven't really done any down and dirty testing on that or research to see. It's a concept. We're saying, okay, you can do this. The other concept there is that the large ones can also be used as a flying hotel. There's so many different uses for these aircraft that it's pretty remarkable.
So it'd be just like a cruise ship then.
Exactly.
Okay, Representative Hughes has a question or comment.
All right, and we do want you to get through your slides, but I know I had this question going away yesterday, so I'm going to remember and ask it today. So small, medium, large, $45 million, $83 million, $273 million. Can you compare that to the cost of aircraft that would carry that equivalent numbers of passengers or cargo for those sizes, and tell us what it would cost for those aircraft, and what mention what type of aircraft, and so that we'll know the cost to construct it, and then also the operating cost, the comparison cost for the airship versus comparable aircraft for those loads.
And Representative,
it's a very good question, and we can start with the comparison, the size comparison. The large aircraft would be equivalent to a 747, cost-wise. So keep in mind, I think a 747 only carries something like 200 passengers, 250 passengers. The large would carry 2,800 passengers. The cost of a 747 is $273 million. The medium size would be equivalent to a C-7, which is basically a cargo ship. And that particular ship, for example, it will carry about three times the load capacity as a C-5. The cost of a C-5 is $120 million. Medium size is $83 million. The small, being at $45 million, would be equivalent to a C-10. And that cost would be about, am I talking the same thing? C-301J. Those would run about $66 million and would carry the small one would carry three times the amount of payload.
Okay. So follow up,
Representative.
So just concentrating on the small one, for $45 million we could carry triple the load that we could for an aircraft that would cost $66 million. Is that what you just said?
Correct, and it's equivalent to a C-130J.
And then as follow up. Madam Chair, the operating, because you told us the construction or the cost for the aircraft themselves, so operating them, annual operating, how does that compare with fuel cost?
Annual operating cost is about a third the cost of a fixed-wing aircraft. And, depending on the type of load, where it's going, you have to bring that into it's a factor you have to bring into the equation. So if you're doing local, if you're doing what I mean by local, say you're using these aircraft statewide, it would be economically feasible, more feasible, to use the hybrid aircraft than it would be to use the fixed wing. If you're going international, in some cases it's cheaper, in some cases it's more expensive, depending on the round trips, back and forth, the payloads, et cetera, et cetera, how quick the cargo needs to get there. A lot of factors you have to weigh into it. And we've done a study, and we can get some of those excerpts to you if you're interested.
Okay, thank you very much. Just for the record, I wanted to show that Representative Johnson has joined us, and a little earlier, Representative Higgins has joined us. So, and Representative Lynn has a question.
We're forgetting about speed here. We were talking about, you know, if we want to fly from here to Prudhoe Bay, we don't want to go 60 miles an hour as compared to what any jet could do, or even a Cessna 172 for that matter. And so you wouldn't be moving large numbers of people, 1,600 people from here to some project, I wouldn't imagine. So it's, you know, speed is part of the equation here. So to me, this would be could be very, very effective. We're moving large pieces of equipment out to mines and parts of bridges, you know, and so on. But as a passenger carrier, it wouldn't be very feasible. It seems like to me, except for very, very short distances. I don't know how long it takes a 60 mile an hour to go from here to Prudhoe Bay, but I wouldn't want to be on that trip.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Again, it all depends on the application, and you're absolutely right. You know, these are basically designed for other than passenger transport. You know, but then again, the application is there. It depends on the type of application. Again, if it's just a tourist attraction thing, or if it's a safe shot over the bay to you know, just to hop where the seas are rough, or you can't, you know, a safety factor. You know, then you would use something like that.
Thank you.
That's where the application would come in.
Representative Higgins has a question.
Thank you. And it's probably unfair that I've already heard your presentation once already. But so I've had 24 hours to think about it. And okay, my question, and you might have answered this already because I came in late. And I'm just going to take your small one, your 25-ton airship. What's, and I think I asked this yesterday, how much helium does it take, cubic feet, to fill that? And do you know what the cost is? The other question I got to follow that up with, once you fill it, how long does it take, how long does that take for that helium to dissipate, or where you got to keep re-energizing it, too? So do you kind of get my question?
I do. And I'm not sure if the handout is on your desk or on your table there, but for the 20-ton, the envelope volume is 1.2 million, or basically 1.3 million cubic feet. So the helium, and as I tried to explain yesterday, the way that the aircraft is designed, it's designed with three ballonets. So there's three lobes, three ballonets. And what that means is there's three lobes connected together, but inside each one of those lobes, there's a ballonet, which is better known as a bladder. That will take up three quarters of the interior, and that's filled with air. The perimeter of the space between the outer envelope and the ballonets is helium. And that will keep, that the only reason we use the helium basically is to keep the integrity of the structure together. It acts as a kind of as a frame, basically. And what this ballonet does, yes, you're going to lose a little helium here and there, depending. I mean, there's some leaks, there's some dissipation. It's very minimal, but unless you get a, you know, a gaping hole, you know, you would then have to, you know, refill. you know, maintenance is on these are, you know, quarterly, so you would have to go in and recharge the helium. And basically what that means is you take it out, you clean it, you put it back in. The Balinese, actually will keep that, frame compressed. You know, you can fill it with air, so it keeps everything nice and taut. The cost of the helium, at this point, you know, is all inclusive of the sale. And I'm not sure exactly per gallon or per cubic foot the helium is going for right now. And, I wish I had that answer, but I don't. So I apologize.
So in other words, if the, when you buy it, it's full, ready to go, and that hardly needs to be adjusted unless something happens that you lose some of it.
Exactly, exactly. And then when you go in for your maintenance, it gets checked, it gets refilled, brought back up to standard.
Okay, thank you. And let the record show that Representative Tarr has joined us.
Thank you.
And go ahead, Representative Higgins.
Just kind of on a follow-up on that note, you know, and I'm obviously not an expert on helium, but I have bought helium balloons at the store, and you know, after a week, they're on my floor. So my question, you know, that's what, I mean, you're telling me that when you buy this airship, it's full of helium, that it never loses its charge? Is that what you're suggesting? Or
no, that's not what I'm indicating. What I'm indicating is that it will lose some. But when you go in for maintenance, the required maintenance that these ships are required to do, you know, that's required by the FAA and by us as well, that will be checked. So they will check when it goes in for the maintenance, repair, et cetera, the charge will be checked to see where it's at, and then it'll be brought up to standard. So if any has been lost, it will be replenished.
And then one more. And then you said that this is done quarterly, so it's every 3 months or so, or every 4 months that this would be done.
Correct.
Okay.
It's just like any. It would be just like any fixed wing. Not as often, but you know, we like to make sure that these aircraft are checked, and that's the way that the schedule is laid out now. The longer that these are in production and the longer we go, the more we'll learn about them and the more that maintenance program will be adjusted along the way.
Okay, Representative Hughes has a question.
Yes, and looking at the handout and the specifications, I see diesel is required, and I'm guessing that's for the takeoff. And what about once the airship is in the air, the helium is help holding it up, but is the diesel, are we still burning diesel for the movement? And I believe yesterday there was mention that you might be working on something to get away from diesel possibly in the future.
Yeah, basically the engines on this on these aircraft are Mercedes engines, and they're basically diesel engine. So it's basic diesel fuel, drop-in diesel fuel. What we're working on is a biodiesel that would take the place of the standard diesel for these airship, which would burn 98% clean. And that's a drop-in fuel as well. So, yes, the buoyancy, it's not like a helium balloon. It's like an aircraft, a regular aircraft. It is you know, it's got buoyant lift, but you know, it's built so that the aerodynamics and the lift are, once it gets going, is taken up into the air. So it's not like you can take the shut off the engines and it'll just sit there. It would drop down. So eventually, it would float back.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead. I don't see any other questions. And you were at tourism, and now I guess you're going on to disaster relief.
Correct.
Oh, Representative, has a question.
Let's see. I think we disaster relief. You know, like Hurricane Katrina. If the ships would have been there, it could have saved a lot of lives by coming in and being able to pick up passengers and pull them out, and having the hospitals on board, that would also have been a key factor there. One of the beauties of this ship is it can land on water as well as land. So, very, very optional craft. So, it would definitely behoove FEMA, for example, to have these ships in service.
Okay, now you're talking about a hospital inside the ship. Okay, what about, or inside your aircraft or whatever you call it? So you have this. Could you just have it sitting on the ground, and that's where the hospital is, and then if something happens, you just pick it up and take it somewhere, and can you do that, or is that...
Absolutely. That would be the optimal. I don't think that you would, although it flies fairly stable, I'm not sure that you would want to really, you know, try and do a number of operations in the air. The main purpose would be to actually get to point A, drop down, and be able to treat your patients at that point in time, not having to evac them and then get them to a hospital. So this would be very critical for life-threatening issues where you've only got a couple hours.
Okay. Representative Lynn has a question.
Yes, thank you. Earlier you talked about fly-by-wire controls, and it's my understanding, I've never flown fly-by-wire, but as I said, there's no mechanical connection, no mechanical linkage, it's simply wire. But what does that have to do with crosswinds precisely? You're talking about some program to deal with crosswinds, because what does fly-by-wire have to do with dealing with a crosswind? Like if you have some something programmed in there to deal with the crosswind. I don't understand that.
Okay, I'm not the engineer, but according to Lockheed's engineers, they were having issues with the crosswinds. Okay. And then when they programmed the fly-by-wire, they were able to minimize those. They were able to minimize those issues. And the fact that these engines, all these engines on the side of the ship that you see, they rotate 180 degrees. So they can rotate up, down, sideways, and they're able to combat whatever the element is right there.
I can see that through the chair. I can see that with the movable engines, perhaps dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead and go on to the next one. Yeah, we've been
okay,
trying to move along a little
bit. Search and rescue, pretty much the same thing. You can drop down into water if a ship capsizes. You can get out there, and instead of using a Sikorsky helicopter and dropping people down, the Coast Guard or whatever, you can take the ship, land it, and pick the survivors up directly. Fishing, another situation where you can fly out, unload the fishing boats onto the airship, and they can stay at sea provided they have the fuel, and then bring the cargo back in, the fish in. So another option. Firefighting capabilities. There's a lot of, I'm sure there's a lot of forest fires that start in Alaska by lightning and other factors. The potential for these airships to combat fires is huge. You can take a large one and put containers on the bottom side, that liquid containers that can fight fires fly in and douse them out. Same thing with a, for example, an oil platform. If that becomes on fire, these are designed. We have some new technologies that will actually be able to fight the oil derricks from a distance. So you're not putting the aircraft in danger, but you can fight that fire from a very logistical distance and put that fire out.
Now, Michael, are there any other companies across the world using any of this technology already?
No, not in this particular case, because obviously these the airship can hover, whereas there's no other craft that could utilize the spray. Now, when you're talking about using the nozzles and the pumps on fixed craft like ground fire engines or stationary platforms, that technology is there, and this has just been converted to fit the airship.
Right, but
there's actually, and I don't have the if you go to, I'm not sure which page that is. I think 15 or 16. There's where the oil platform is. There's a small picture in the upside corner there that shows that technology.
Oh yes. Now, I'm not talking about that technology itself. I'm talking about the air, the hybrid media or the aircraft that you're talking about. The airship, is that being used anywhere else in the world at this present time?
No, there are no airships anywhere that have been produced and or flown. There are two major companies out there right now that are trying, other than Lockheed Martin, and those companies are far from. They're probably about 5 years behind the Lockheed technology, so we won't see them flying anytime soon. So we would have saturated the market before those particular craft come out.
All right, continue.
Unless somebody's building one in their garage that we don't know about.
Okay. Oh, Representative Lynn, or Representative Gaddis has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't help but thinking as you're talking, and now is a great time to ask it when we talked about other ships being in service. So, I guess I would ask, what is it that you're, from a reputation standpoint and certainly from a financial standpoint, that you're fighting from back in the day, the perception, and what is, do you have an uphill battle that you're dealing with? Why didn't we do this 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago? So, and so why are we doing it now versus then, and what may have happened then that kept us from doing what we did then? And I'm sure you know what I'm alluding to, but, it is a conversation that I think everybody thinks of when we get to this point.
Yeah. In a nutshell, I know what you're alluding to as far as, everybody looks at the past experience with the Hindenburg and they're going, okay, well, why not, or why hasn't somebody developed it sooner? There was that stigmatism for a long time, and just recently, and I want to say, when I say recently, it's been over the past 10 years that people have really, engineers have started to look at the options for a hybrid aircraft, or this, what people now call the blimp, the alternative. And it wasn't until 10 years ago that they've actually realized that there was another way to build an operational vehicle of this type and make it safe. For example, now it uses helium and air and it's more aerodynamic. Before it was just a long tube and a lot of helium, or not a lot of hydrogen. So, that was a scary piece of equipment. But this type of aircraft is the safest thing that would be in the air. You can take they've already done tests on this vehicle, and they realize that you can take an AK-47 and riddle the side of this aircraft, and it will not come out of the sky. Yes, it will start losing a lot of helium, but then again, the beauty of the bladder, for example, the ballonets, is that you just increase the oxygen, it just keeps everything taut. You will come down slowly, and there's a patch kit, basically, that you can put on this, and the outer envelope has a tensile strength of 1,500 pounds per square inch, and the patch kit also contains the same amount of tensile strength. So once it's patched, it's patched. Somebody asked what happens if an RPG goes through it. Well, that's all it's going to do. If someone shoots an RPG, it needs to be triggered once it hits, but the RPG will basically just go through, leaving a gaping hole. And again, this is where the patch sequence comes in. It'll drift down at about 10 miles an hour, losing altitude. But once it hits, it's like a big balloon. It just, the cargo bay and everything is protected because of the landing gear, will protect everything in the cargo bay. So whatever that cargo is, precious cargo as well, no one gets hurt. It just lands. If it happens in the water, it'll still float. So the safety factor is quite high here on these particular aircraft.
Representative Gaddis has a follow-up question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for your answer in regards to essentially why we may have not looked at these before. And if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that not only did we have a stigma years and years ago, but we didn't have the technology, maybe that's what you were saying, to scientific knowledge, if you will. But do finances play a part in this? Are we at a place where fuel is so expensive that we have a lot of other issues that factor into the fact that we might want to relook at some old engineering or at least participate in kind of, I would say old because it implies that we're not using the science, but is there a reason that I would say a company would be looking at doing this? Are there finances involved?
When you say finances,
let me narrow it down. I guess what I really mean is, does fuel play a factor?
Well, yeah, fuel. I mean, there are a number of factors involved. Let's take shipping for example. To give you another idea of hard cargo on the 500-ton ship. Okay, we'll use that for our reference. That particular ship has the capability of hauling a payload of 300 automobiles. Now, with a payload like that, and it has the ability to go, I believe it's 2,800 miles the range on that is 6,800 miles. At a cruising speed of 100 knots. So when you take in the shipping aspect, let's take Detroit for example. When Detroit is shipping vehicles over to China or overseas, period, they have to, from their factory, put the vehicles on a train, put it on rail, rail it to the coast, put it on a ship, and the ship takes a month plus to get to the other side, then it goes on another train or a hauler to its destination. With these craft, you can go right to the facility, load up, and it's what we call point to point. So you can load up at Detroit, and you can fly over the pond and deliver without having to go through port to port to port to port. You're eliminating a number of steps, which is decreasing the cost to ship. And this can be used in a number of different scenarios. I know that Maersk and Costco and a number of shipping companies are very interested in joining the fray on these airships because of the cost effectiveness that they have. Here in the U.S., you know, rail still will be the basically king, only because, you know, it's easier to put something on a rail and ship it across. But then when you get into locations that are, you know, a rail doesn't go, now this is where the airship becomes very, very effective. Let's take LNG. Let's take oil. You've got a pipeline that comes in. At the end of that pipeline, you're going to have to distribute. Well, how do you distribute? Well, you put it on trucks, and then everybody goes. With an airship, you don't necessarily need to go to that pipeline. You can go to the Bakken, for example, load up there, or any other field, load up, and then distribute from that point. So it has a number of advantages that we wouldn't really necessarily look at without seeing what the capabilities of this vehicle are. So when you look at, is it just fuel that's going to be the economic driver? No, it's a number of factors.
Okay.
But I hope I answered that question.
And we have Representative Lynn with the question, and then a follow-up with Representative Higgins.
Yeah. What's the timeline on this thing? When are we going to have, when's it going to come out of the factory ready to fly? When's it going to arrive in Alaska? What's happening? When?
Okay. Our generalized right now, our schedule is that we are going to close our deal with Lockheed Martin April 1st. It will then take them 9 to 10 months to get the first aircraft up. Once that aircraft is out of the hangar, that aircraft will then come to Alaska. So we're looking at February of next year, February or March of next year.
One quick
follow up, Representative.
Are you going to fly it to Alaska, or are you going to ship it to Alaska?
No, we're going to fly.
You'll fly. Thank you.
But make sure,
absolutely.
Make sure you let us know so that we can be on step with it. Representative Higgins.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Hey, a quick question here. I know the fabric that you're using obviously has been produced already. What is the lifespan of one of these airships?
You know, the envelope needs to be replaced every 15 years. So, you know, the lifespan is fairly long, but when you replace the envelope, which is at a estimated cost right now of $5 million. When you purchase the vehicle, you have to, you know, factor that in, that, you know, that's probably one of the maintenance issues that you'll have to contend, or, you know, the depreciation that you put into this vehicle. But you replace the envelope every 15 years.
Okay. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to put in an official request that you stop in Juneau on your way to Anchorage when you bring it up so that maybe we could see it. And I would like to suggest maybe we look at slide 9, because the payload and the ability to haul things is probably, like as you were saying, that the passenger feature is just something for sightseeing that might be nice, but really the advantage is to be able to carry heavy equipment and things, as Representative Lynn mentioned, in areas where we don't have rail, don't have roads, and so we've been Ginger, while you were talking, was going through some of the slides, since we only got the first few slides in your presentation, so that we could see those things. So I don't know if there's anything that you want to point out in some of those further slides.
We basically covered almost all of the abilities of this aircraft. One of the other issues would be, you know, when you have deforestation, where you have areas that have died and create a fire hazard, These airships are able to go in, and you're able to use it in logging, and you can do it either internal or external. They have the ability to go in and clean up this mess. That would be creating jobs in the forest management area as well, and logging. So it all has. There are a number of uses, and I'm sure that somebody's going to come up with even more. It was brought to my attention the other day that a group that put satellites into orbit, they wind up spending over $500 million just getting the satellite and the rocket booster from point A to launch. And so what they were saying is that, you know, there's so many issues that go along with that when it's on a truck, that this airship would be the ideal solution to that. Carrying windmills, for example, becomes very routine, very simple, very safe. The number of things that this airship can do is only left to the imagination, basically.
Well, that's amazing.
I know someone mentioned, asked a question yesterday about being able to take platforms when it freezes over or whatever out into specific areas. Depending on what the weight of that platform is, there's that ability, but if you were able, depending on how the platform is constructed, if it were to take three or four trips for an airship to take that platform out and then be reconstructed on site in the water, however, I'm not really sure how they're, you know, the ones you're talking about are done. But if you had to take two or three trips, it would still pay for itself above and beyond because of the fact that if you get the oil platform working, the revenue generated from that platform is going to supersede whatever the cost was to get the platform from A to B. So, again, a number of factors in play here.
Okay, you know what? We have about 8 more minutes that we can spend. Is there anything that you would like to say that you haven't said up to this point? And you know, when you very first started, you really didn't go into very much the difference between the hydrogen and the helium, the difference in those two products, and the actual safety factor, and you didn't go into that too much. You just kind of went right into it, and because this committee hasn't heard the things that a couple of the other members of the committee have already heard, you might want to mention that. But go ahead and just give us any of the other information that you haven't had a chance to sum up.
Okay, basically, I'll just jump right into that subject, and that goes back to the safety factor of these airships. Again, hydrogen is very volatile, and the spark factor is right there. Whereas helium, on the other hand, has zero combustion factor, a zero combustion factor. So again, if you bump into something or something gets hit by lightning, for example, this ship is not going to explode. It's not going to be taken out of the air. It will not be affected in any way, shape, or form. Possibly if it hits an engine, it could damage the engine, but it is not going to take the aircraft out of the sky in any way. So being that it's a polymer and it's impervious to electricity. So The safety factor rates very high on this aircraft. It won't say that it has a fixed airplane beat in any way, because it doesn't. It just has advantages that a fixed aircraft does not. So they're both very useful, and we understand that this could definitely change the dynamics of Alaska in a number of ways. It's just once you start putting these into action in Alaska, you will just continue to find more and more ways of utilizing this craft.
I'm sure that is so very true, and thank you very much for your presentation. Do we have any final questions, Representative Hughes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to make a closing comment. And while I do, Ginger, if you could please find the LNG transport slide. I think it's about slide 15. I wish you luck, Michael and Curtis, with this technology. It's it could be a game changer if we're able to work these things out. When it costs two-thirds to build a similar aircraft that would carry and sometimes even less of a payload, and I believe you said a third to operate on an annual basis, would be quite amazing if this technology does pan out. And I just want everyone to see this final slide. It kind of looks like a cartoon whale, and somebody else said it looked a little bit like a toilet seat, but this is an artist rendering, Michael, of what an airship might look like that would be transporting LNG. We are looking right now at getting engaged in an LNG project in this state, and so I just wanted people to kind of see that. Of course, we don't have it. This is just an artist rendering, but I wanted to give you a chance, Michael, if you wanted to say anything about that.
Yeah, again, like you say, it's an artist rendering, and to be totally honest, we're showing you just the difference of what an LNG transport may look like, but in all reality, it will probably retain the same shape, and what we will do is that the aircraft does now, but on the underside, we would wind up changing the payload bay to be cylindrical tanks, basically. And there's no way that you could fill this whole thing with LNG and have it fly. It's just basically trying to tell you there's a difference here. But the option to put the tanks for LNG are there. As a matter of fact, we're in discussions with another group in Louisiana that are already asking for orders. So we've already got our engineers working on a new design just for LNG alone to make it a safe transport. And that would probably, it would only take place on the 100 and the 500-ton aircraft. And we will definitely keep you posted on that progress as well.
Okay, is there the possibility that you could take it directly from the treatment plant up on the slope and take it down to where it needs to be shipped out without having to build a pipeline?
Absolutely. Absolutely. These are able to sit down right at the source. They're able to fill up at the source and take it to wherever the delivery point would be.
Very interesting.
Yeah, another situation where you eliminate a lot of high costs, just like you would in mining. You eliminate the infrastructure, and then you have the ability to go from point A to point B, so point to point. Again, very economical. More economical than it would be to, you could probably, by the time you built a pipeline, you could probably purchase, I would say, a few dozen of these aircraft to do the hauling. But you wouldn't need to. I mean, if you have them in service, a few of these would go a long way for that specific reason.
So maybe,
or application, rather.
I'm just I'm just dreaming here, joyfully thinking about this. And so we could start at the up in Prudhoe Bay and then go down to Fairbanks and drop off some things for Fairbanks and then cut over and hit a couple villages and different places all the way down to Anchorage or even Nikiski.
Absolutely. Now, keep in mind that when you go to point to point, and you can, and stopping along the way. Now, you don't need to go to an actual distribution center. You can do exactly what you just mentioned. You can drop into each one of these areas and deliver. So that's eliminating any trucking that you're having to dispatch from the distribution point. More economical, again, and safer.
But and you could actually just, instead of taking it off and stopping down so it can get on a ship, you could just take it on to Japan or anywhere, India or China.
Anywhere. Absolutely. If you were selling, to Japan, China, Russia, wherever, you would go point to point. You'd take the 500, which has got a range of 6,800 miles, and load to capacity and go from fill up at the point to wherever its destination is.
Okay. I'm going to follow up right here, and then we're going to have to end. So you're going to do the testing. You think that April 1st you'll be able to start doing something. How soon? What's the, like, what is the deadline that you're going to be in Alaska?
I honestly would say right at this point, February, March of next year.
Of next year. And then you what I'm saying, for lack of better terminology, you'll do the beta testing and see how it goes. And then if we wanted to say, okay, we're ready to do something, how long would that take? If we wanted to buy four ships or something.
Well, for example, depending on the size ship, now let me explain. Lockheed Martin will be building all of the 25-ton aircraft out of Palmdale. We are in the process of acquiring 1,000 acres at the Millington Naval Base in Tennessee to build a new hangar to be able to manufacture the 100-ton and the 500-ton. That alone is going to take us 2 years to get up and running. Lockheed wants at least 1 year of production on the 20-ton before the 100-ton, before they jump to the 100-ton and the 500. So I'm saying probably by the end of 20 or the early mid 17, first part of 2018 is when we'd see the 100-ton. But that's not to say that we could not utilize the 20-ton, or the 25-ton, rather, for transport for LNG immediately. Because I when you're talking about delivering to small villages and towns along the way, the smaller aircraft would probably be more apropos for that.
Okay, thank you so very much for your presentation, and we will just... we're going to be listening to the news to hear more information on your whole presentation and when things are going to be happening. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having us.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we are going to gavel out of the joint committee. Thank you, everyone, and we are calling the House Transportation meeting to order, and it is 20 minutes after 2 on March 4th, 2014, And let the record show that we have Representative Johnson, Representative Lynn, Representative Gaddis, Vice Chair Representative Isaacson, and myself, Representative Wilson. And our recording secretary is Nancy Hemingway. Our LIO monitor is Sam, and Becky Rooney is my, who just went out the door, is my committee aide. And before we start, please turn off your cell phones and put them on, or put them on airplane mode. So now we are going to go ahead and hear House Bill. What is it? House Bill 271. And Representative Isaacson, would you like to introduce your person that is going to... Actually, let me explain that a little bit, first of all. Paul Metz is going to be our... He's from the University of Fairbanks. And I do not plan on moving this bill out today, but we are having this today because... Representative Isaacson wants to have Mr. Metz to go ahead and explain. He feels that he can explain it much better than anyone else.
And if I may, by introduction.
Okay, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is, I really appreciate the honor of being able to have this possible rail extension, at least the methodology and the plan for it presented today. I think it's very important for us to get it on the record why this is so important. The need to diversify our economy, as we mentioned the last time this bill was heard, can be helped, greatly aided by the railroad extension. When I was a mayor in North Pole, and we have a lot of the railroad, historically we've had a lot of the freight on the railroad in North Pole, and now with the closure of Flint Hills, that freight has been diminished from a 55% of their revenues down to 15%, and now it's a question mark how much revenue will be provided to the railroad from operations in North Pole. So, but at the time I was mayor, and Pat Gamble, who is now president of the university, was president of the railroad, and he sat in my office, and I asked him, where should the railroad go? And I expected to hear him say, well, let's connect it to the lower 48, or let's get it out to Nome. But I was very surprised to hear him say, it absolutely needs to go north. And I saw him in the hall again today, and here in the Capitol, and he says, and I want to add to that story. He says, not only does it need to go north because of all the resources it develops and opens up, and the costs that are lowered to the communities, the people are able to have transportation year-round on an affordable passenger rail service as well as the heavy freight. But he said, the president of the railroad, he spoke to the president of Conoco, and at that time he said the railroad will cost $5 billion to build, and he said the president of Conoco didn't even blink. Instead he said, yes, and we're expecting to spend at least $105 billion more of capital to extract oil on the North Slope. $5 billion was nothing to $105 billion in capital expenditures, which then would bring multitudes of billions of dollars to the state and to the economy.
Is he stealing your...
No. No, this is by way of introduction. $5 billion, Madam Chairs, we're going to hear what that will do as far as lowering the cost of transportation in multiple industries, and he'll touch on several. Chris Adenson, when he was president of the railroad, said the same thing. So Dr. Metz is here because we were asked whether or not this would be a welfare to the university. And Dr. Metz himself has been involved, and he can touch on this, but he has been involved in multiple projects that have actually become operational. The Tanana Bridge over the... that the legislature just helped to pay for. That was done through studies conducted by Dr. Metz. The Port McKenzie bridge, rail, which is now three-fifths of the way done, Dr. Metz has his hand in that. The G7G effort to bring the rail from Alberta all the way to Delta Junction, Dr. Metz's fingerprints are on this. He has been known for a long time in the mining and the geological engineering realm, and rail has been something that Governor Murkowski tasked him and others. So he is not speaking from a philosophic, empirical, or, you know, from on the hill, as it were. He is talking from real-world experience, so I'm glad that he's here, and I just wanted to make sure that this was on the record, and Dr. Metz is able to explain this very well for us. I'll be quiet and let him talk.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, and Paul, do we call you professor?
No. It's not.
So we will just let you go ahead and give your presentation, and you heard the other one. We were pretty informal. We do ask questions. Would you rather us ask the questions as we go along or wait until the end?
Please ask questions as you see fit, and we'll address them as best we can.
Okay. Thank you. Go right ahead.
And I'm here, and as Representative Isaacson said, we've been involved in this series of studies, and these were not academic exercises that began back in 2000, and this was a really good induction to put it in the context of all of the other rail investigations that have had an immediate impact on the economy of Alaska. The first one that was done, the study for the rail link from Eielson to Delta Junction, was a partnership with Lockheed Martin, who you just heard from, and several other engineering firms, and the Alaska-Canada Rail Link study that was released, phase one was released in 2007, was a joint effort with, again, Lockheed Martin, the HDR Engineering, which is the largest railroad engineering firm in the United States, and Van Horn Institute at the University of Calgary, which is an industry-funded group. It's not a part of the university per se. It's an industry-funded research, applied research group. So we have a context of this. The original Rails to Resources legislation that Senator Frank Murkowski had sponsored and was signed into law in 2000 was to look at the impact of a rail extension or rail extensions on the development of North Slope natural gas. And so we're actually going back, in the first few commissions were on extensions to the east and to the south, and now we're going back to the original basis for the most recent national level discussions on this subject. We're going to be talking about future, and there's two quotes here. What is yet to come is still uncertain. I love this quote from William Shakespeare. And the second one, the future ain't what it used to be, by Yogi Berra. What in the relation that these two guys have together? Well, they're both talking about two aspects of future events. First of all, the future is uncertain, and second is we make projections today, and in the future they are going to be different than what we expect today. 40 years ago, we would have expected that the pipeline that was in the process of being built was going to be built faster than it was, and that it would last, in our collective wisdom, forever. And we know that that's not the case. And so even though there's uncertainty about the future and there's uncertainty with respect to the quality of our projections about the future, that shouldn't prevent us from looking forward instead of backwards. Alaska's future is tied to the oil patch, and it will be for a very, very long time. The major source of oil revenues began in 1977, and now we see that they're dwindling very, very rapidly. But there's still enormous resources on the North Slope, at least 40 billion plus barrels of conventional oil that is yet to be produced, and probably something in excess of 100 billion barrels of unconventional oil. The petroleum resource and reserves are two concepts that are often confused. The petroleum resource is something that might be potentially useful. A petroleum reserve is one that can be produced under current economic conditions using current technologies. And so a very large portion of our resources on the North Slope are resources, and to convert those to reserves is going to entail large capital investments by the private sector. And for that to happen, we have to have a competitive economic climate to produce those resources. There's a huge surge in petroleum production in the continental states in 2011 and since on a technology that was first patented in 1947, the concept of hydrofracking, pumping fluids in the ground, breaking the rocks, and increasing the porosity of the source beds for both oil and gas. Today, the Bakken in North Dakota and Montana and Eagle Ford in Texas are producing large quantities of oil, and there are large quantities of natural gas being produced in the eastern states, the Marcellus Shale and other units. The West Texas oil field that produced about 35 billion barrels of oil, larger than the historic production of crude oil, was estimated in 1980 by the Carter administration to contain 100 billion barrels of oil in the source beds. Those source beds projected to the surface would cover an area of about 10,000 square miles. The Shoebreak Formation, one of the source beds in the North Slope, covers an area or underlies an area of about 30,000 square miles. So it's the size of the country of Ireland, and it is three times larger than the West Texas. So we have tremendous potential resources on the North Slope, but we've got to change those resources into reserves. Hydraulic fracturing has only been conducted on the North Slope in relatively small levels for really investigatory purposes rather than major production. And the reason for that is there's high cost of operations on the North Slope. Wells produced by fracking shale units do not have the same levels of productivity as conventional oil reservoirs, and they have much higher costs. So the margins are much narrower.
I'm going to stop you right here and ask a question. You said because high costs up there, and also it says including our high tax rates.
Historic tax rate.
Okay. Now, I'm going to ask you, in your opinion, Senate Bill 21, do you think that that's important?
It's absolutely important. It's absolutely essential that we reduce the taxes to make them more competitive, and you'll see a slide here very shortly to that, addressing that.
Thank you.
The consequence, there's been no surge in oil production on the North Slope with respect to fracking. And another quote here that I really like is from Winston Churchill, is a pessimist sees difficulty in every opportunity, and the optimist sees an opportunity in every difficulty. And that's what we really, a pessimist never drilled a mine, never drilled an oil well, never produced anything of significance. And this is what the historian Kenneth Clark, how he defines civilization versus periods of dark ages, is one that was optimism about the future. You have to be optimistic about the future. The Arctic oil bonanza that never occurred. There's a lot of misconceptions about this huge oil patch on the North Slope, and one of them is that it produced huge rates of return to the oil and gas industry. And in a very interesting and well-written discussion, John Miller in 2010 demonstrated that the Atlantic Richfield Company that found oil on our slope could have made a higher rate of return by putting their money in federal bonds, risk-free bonds, than they did from operating on the North Slope. And that was due to the high cost of operations and the extensive delays. It took less time when a decision was made to put a man on the moon. It took less time to do that than it did to get a permit to build the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline.
What a shame.
Constraints on Northern Oil Natural Gas Development, as I said earlier, high cost. Well, those aren't just words from me or from the oil and gas industry. The high cost of operations on the North Slope are well documented by the Defense Department. I worked for 6 years for the Air Force, just in the Air Force for 6 years, and what I did is cost out projects all over the state and in Greenland and elsewhere. And what we found is that the cost indices for the North Slope were extremely high. And this is due to long supply lines, remote areas, extreme environmental conditions. And when we add on top of that high tax burdens relative to the tax burdens that occur in other jurisdictions, we're producing a huge economic hurdle that has been very difficult for people to overcome, including ARCO. Reducing oil taxes has been an essential and necessary first step in this process. Developing a railroad to the North Slope to handle large volumes of bulk commodities, low unit cost materials, will have an enormous impact on that cost differential between North Slope and others areas of oil production in North America. In addition, that railroad will have a backhaul capability, a new concept for the railroad, having a backhaul of mineral concentrates south to ports in south central Alaska for export around the world. So as part of these studies, I developed an ArcGIS-based freight forecast system that's been published in the Transportation Research Board and been given in a number of conferences. It's not an academic exercise. It's a really important fundamental exercise in determining what you're going to haul on this rail system that you plan to build or pipeline system or any other transportation system. And here shows the proposed corridor from Nenana, or the little siding just north of Nenana, at Dunbar, to Prudhoe Bay. And for all of our studies, we looked at what would be the impact of this corridor on the mineral resources within 50 miles on either side of that transportation corridor. The idea that mine owners would fund either rail spurs or road connections to the rail corridor in which to transport materials out and resupply in. From Nenana to Prudhoe Bay, in that 100-mile wide corridor, there's over 600 known mineral occurrences. There'd be a lot more if there was a railroad system there, because there'd be a huge incentive to do that exploration. Well, let's just quickly look at these cost factors. In some of these slides, I'm going to go through fairly quickly. You have them in front of you, and the arithmetic you can follow later. It's very simple. The North Slope, of course, all of the DOD facilities there are closed down, but these numbers didn't change very much from the time I worked there in the late 60s and early 70s to the present, relative factors. The cost of operations on the Aleutians are about the same, and we're the same, and are would be the same today, about between 4 and 4.5 times what they are in the continental United States. The index is based on an average of all DOD contracts nationwide, construction contracts nationwide. So it gives us an index of what it costs relative to the lower 48. So if we look at where fracking is occurring elsewhere in East Texas or the state of Texas on the average, the cost of North Slope relative to East Texas is about 6.5 times. Relative to the state of Texas as a whole is about 5 times. So these aren't percentages. These are factors of times. These are huge, huge cost differentials. So let's just look at a quick scenario here on what might be the benefits and the cost of this rail extension. Great Bay Petroleum in 2012 announced that they would like to drill 200 wells a year on the North Slope, applying horizontal drilling and hydrofracking to produce oil from the Shublik Formation and other source beds on the North Slope. Looking at these quantities, the depth of the Shublik versus the shale units in the Bakken and the Eagle Ford, the remote locations and the need for servicing these wells, I've estimated those 200 wells a year would require about 12,000 tons of freight per well, or 2.5 million tons a year. Well, that's 2.5 times the amount of concentrates that are hauled out of Red Dog every year, and it's right near Tidewater. So this is a huge amount of freight that would have to be sent north. It would be equivalent to 500-car trains, which would carry 10,000 tons per train, 5 of those a week, 52 weeks a year, or roughly 168 18-wheelers that could legally carry 40 tons, which they can't always, per day going one way. And so we're talking about enormous volumes of freight. It would be huge traffic volumes on the Dalton Highway. And that doesn't include, of course, the backhaul that might occur from the development of these mineral resources. I added here a map just to show you, everyone of course knows the geography of Alaska, but to remind you that there's another very large oil resource to the east at the Mackenzie River Delta, and there are huge oil resources offshore to the northwest, as well as very large coal resources on the North Slope that all would benefit from this rail connection.
One question.
Representative Isaacson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Oh, boy. I'm not feeling well. She knows it. So the question has come up before. Why not bring the rail, just say, from Dead Horse to maybe the Brooks Range or something? Why do we need to take it all the way from Nanana or Fairbanks all the way up there? Can it be done differently and still achieve the same benefit if you are freighting it, say getting it onto water up at Dead Horse or something?
Actually, what we're talking about is connecting this rail to Huntsville, Alabama, eventually. Putting the drilling steel on a rail car, running it across the country, putting on a rail barge, or rail marine barge system, bringing it into South Central Alaska, and then delivering it to the North Slope. Yes, we could avoid building a tunnel under Attigan Pass, bringing the rail that far, but then you'd have to offload that material and handle it again, put it on a truck, haul it to the North Slope, and then unload it again. And so the thought that a tunnel under Attigan Pass is a daunting exercise, it really isn't.
Now, where on this map is Attigan Pass?
It's, as you see that little highway number there.
Yes.
Just north of Coldfoot.
Uh-huh.
That's Attigan Pass.
Okay.
You'll get a little better view.
And this is a core. This would be a corridor. When you were talking about the mineral possibilities, that was just 50 miles on each side.
That's an arbitrary width that we've estimated is what a moderate-sized mine could probably bear the cost, the capital cost of a road. If it was a very, very large mine, then it might bear the cost of a rail over that distance. But there is a utility corridor north of the Yukon River that has been set aside as federal land that is designated as a transportation corridor. And we often forget about that. I did an assessment for the Bureau of Mines of all the mineral sources in that corridor that were known back in 1975, 76, and 77. In places that corridor is 18 miles or three townships wide.
Okay.
Well, just to look at just a couple of quick photos to see the terrain. What you're looking at here is some brown dirt that's north of Livengood in the Hess Creek area from Livengood to the Yukon River. Some very challenging permafrost conditions. Some areas of very high relief, very steep slopes. I've driven to the north slope during the pipeline construction and we're actually doing the assessment. Left Fairbanks and never saw anything but taillights until I got to Prudhoe Bay. That's how tough the road system was at that time. As we go further north, of course, the relief gets even higher in the central part of the Brooks Range. And as we go up the Chandelier Shelf, here we see extreme grades, the 13-14% grades, and then it gets even higher as we go up over Attigan Pass.
And when you're in a semi, that just is pretty scary.
It is. And then, of course, getting back down the other side in Attigan Valley here and then on to the North Slope, pulling the grade out of near Pump 4 at Galbraith Lake. Very challenging grades and permafrost conditions. And the route that I've laid out, we've tried to utilize the braided stream valleys as best as possible and keep that alignment at near a horizontal grade at 1%. Okay, well, let's just look at the difference that the freight would be for rail versus truck and the cost differential there. At 12,000 tons per well, just the cost from Fairbanks, 470 miles at $1 a ton mile, that would add the cost to the well about $5.5 million. From Dunbar, or just north of Prudhoe, to Prudhoe's 450 miles, a little bit shorter because it's a great stretch reach due north from Nenana. At 10 cents a ton mile, the cost there would be about $550,000. The cost, this analysis, this benefit cost analysis, isn't from the point of view of the oil companies or the trucking industry. It's from the point of view of the state. So what we really need to do is look at what is the cost of this project and what are the revenues that are going to accrue to the state of Alaska. Now, obviously, there's going to be some huge benefits that will accrue to the oil industry from reducing their freight costs. There'll be huge benefits to the trucking industry because there'll be more revenue in the treasury and more economy in the state as a whole, and a lot more freight being shipped elsewhere in the state in addition to Prudhoe Bay. So what I've done here is I used the unit cost that we got from our previous studies of about $6 million a mile for that 450 miles that I've laid out. Actually, we had a route map that we've nearly completed on this already. I looked at a tunnel at those brown rocks south of the Yukon River, terrible rocks that with those steep grades, it's easier to tunnel through them. If you've ever driven the Dalton Highway, you'll know that the Yukon River Bridge is at a 7% incline. It's that way because of those basaltic rocks that's just south of the river. So you have to tunnel through those. And what I use for unit cost of that tunnel is that we don't have a recent tunnel being constructed in the state, but I used the unit cost of a very long, very expensive, very deep tunnel that's almost finished in a very high cost area of the Alps. And that unit cost of $2.5 million a mile, I think, is very excessive. but it makes for a very conservative estimate of this project cost. But at an impasse, we would be looking at a longer tunnel of about 4.5 miles. The tunnel in the Alps is 57 kilometers long, and it's over 1,000 meters deep. And so we're talking about a much easier tunneling project, even at Attigan Pass, than the tunnel across, the rail tunnel across the Alps, the new one that's near completion. The Yukon River Bridge, I estimated that at $500 million, and I think that's extremely conservative as well. The original bridge that was built there was about $31 million, the highway bridge. Obviously, isn't going to service a railroad. So I think my costs here are very conservative, and what we've got is something in the neighborhood of $5.2 billion, including provisions for a terminal on the North Slope. The benefits to accrue to the state, if we assume that the only benefits the state got from this whole project would be 1/8 royalty in that 200 wells that Great Bear's proposed drilling a year. That was the only benefit. At $85 a barrel, our 1/8 royalty would generate about $1.5 billion a year. 200 wells, 2,000 barrels a day would fill up the pipeline, it would fill up the treasury, and with the potential resource that we have in the North Slope, that would last for a very, very long time. So let's look at the benefit-cost analysis, on which the bottom line is here. Even if we had a required rate of return at 10%, the benefits to the cost are 2.5 times, assuming the only benefit is that royalty oil. If we looked at adjusted rate of return on investment, 30%, well, guess what? Warren Buffett, when he bought the BNSF Railroad, last year, the transportation index went up 30%. So he, I don't think this rate of return is astronomical compared to what is happening in the contiguous states. 60% of the oil that's being transported out of the Bakken's is by rail. Huge amounts of oil are being transported around the world by rail, and we haven't even considered that in this analysis. Way to fund this, we're not going to tap the budget. We're not going to tap the capital budget or the state's budget at all. What the state can do is use the bonding authority of the Alaska Railroad to sell non-recourse revenue bonds. And this is where the wake-up call to make a decision on the project would occur. Those revenue bonds can only be sold if the state of Alaska or the Alaska Railroad in particular could sign long-term contracts guaranteeing that it had a revenue stream to pay those non-recourse revenue bonds back. And so this would be a no-go decision point. To get there, what we have to do is we have to complete a business case that will defend this $5.2 billion capital estimate to the financial community to whom we wish to sell those bonds. And we need to provide that business case to the Surface Transportation Board, which is the agency of authority for all railroad extensions in the United States. So what this $2 million is proposed for is to add to the money that it's been expended so far to bring this analysis up to not a bankable feasibility study, but a defendable business case that can be submitted to the Surface Transportation Board. When we compare this cost to other costs of other feasibility studies, we look at the cost of the feasibility study for some of you that have been here a long time. Remember the Quartz Hill project, the Quartz Hill Molybdenum project in southeastern near Ketchikan. That project had the cost of that feasibility study was $100 million. The cost of the feasibility study to reopen the AJ mine a few years ago by Echo Bay Mines was $100 million. These large capital-intensive projects have to have detailed engineering studies to justify the long future projections that we make about the sources of revenues, to deal with those uncertainties, to make sure that what we predict today will have a reasonable chance of occurring in the future. Other minimal sources, and I'm not going to belabor this one, the long and the short of this slide is that the cost of trucking mineral concentrates from the Brooks Range or other low unit value commodities from the North Slope is too high to justify the development of those projects. The only way these base metal occurrences, like in the copper in the Ambler Schist Belt, or other lead zinc deposits. I had a contract years ago to look at the potential for lead zinc mineralization in the Galbraith Lake area of the Central Brooks Range, similar to what we see at Red Dog. The only way that that resource will ever be exploited will be if there's a rail extension to the North Slope. So, in summary, the logistics for the North Slope, the challenges there can be addressed in part by the railroad, in a very large part. This will give us year-round transportation access to the state's major asset. And that is going to be not something that's going to occur tomorrow. These large projects, the rail extension from Eielson to Delta Junction, I started that in 2003. We didn't have the bridge done until 2013. It took 10 years just for that blank bridge. When we talk about building this whole North Slope project, we should be looking at building it now when that natural gas pipeline is ready to be built so we can haul that pipe up there and help develop the gas fields on the North Slope. Possibly bring gas liquids from Point Thompson back south. But again, that's not included in the analysis. And I warrant here that without a rail extension to the North Slope, it's very unlikely that we're going to see major oil shale or shale gas development on the North Slope. Thank you.
Any questions?
Madam Chair, if no one else
Representative
does.
Isaacson.
Thank you. So I just want to highlight a couple of the mechanics. Again, you said, Paul, that in order for us to actually start a project like this, it is necessary for us to go through certain steps. This feasibility study or proof of concept or business concept is actually the first step, and then you go to, say, someone like the National Transportation Service Board, and they shed some money for the environmental study, and then it comes to the state's responsibility then to actually see the project done. Am I saying this right? And give us the timetable.
Everything except for the STB there's only a couple dozen guys, gals on that board, and they don't have much of a budget. They're not going to fund that EIS. And we could think about what, in terms of that's the next step. We do the business case, STB takes it over, but someone's got to fund that EIS. The EIS for the Eielson to Delta Junction was $20 million. Senator Stevens provided the first 15 after I was half done with that project. We gave him the preliminary report and he said, let's do it. They had to pony up another $5 million later. But generally, the EIS for major projects ranges from 2 to 3% of the capital cost as well. So we're not talking about a trivial amount of money after the business case is made. Now, Norway has a really novel way of approaching oil and gas development. They do the preliminary, if you would, science through funding seismic surveys, then they take the responsibility for completing the environmental impact statements, and then they tender this out to the private sector. So we could think about doing something similar to that here, including in that bonding the cost of the EIS. So the EIS would be funded by the same revenue bonds. The caveat there is, if you do that, there's always the uncertainty that the project will be delayed, and with that, the cost will escalate as a function of delays.
But aren't they? I mean, Norway is a country. And so if the country wants to do something, they can do it easier than a state that has to have permission from our federal government. There's a difference there.
That is a difference. But as I said, the quote from Winston Churchill.
So being follow-up?
Representative Isaacson.
Thanks. So being optimistic and not pessimistic, we need to start this now. So what are the downsides? Right now, in your if we were to be able to fund this study and get this going, the business case then would include talking to folks like those 685 mineral occurrences, notably Great Bear, notably perhaps even Conoco and some of these others, Nova Copper, others in the Ambler, to prove up the case that, and maybe then to invite them into participating in sharing the expense. Am I right in this part? Or?
Yeah, actually, you're right. That needs to be done right up front. All the potential freight hauler or customers should be contacted and included in this analysis, and at least letters of intent or letters of goodwill that should this be built, they would utilize that facility. And then when you go from the EIS, then you do the final feasibility study and sign those. If you would have an open season, that is a firm commitment.
So, Madam Chair, if I could suggest this is something that I would ask for us to take up as a priority. Maybe this, the bill as written, needs to be changed a little bit to be able to get out of committee. But I would certainly invite support of the committee for this project. As you can see, it does hold a tool to help the state down the road in development and the people of the state for jobs and goods and services at a much reduced rate. This is one of the things that can take us on in for decades to come. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I have a question for you. Now, you worked with the G7G and group, and they're really wanting to have something happen too. And so we could even have possibilities of other countries helping us out.
Oh, absolutely. The G7G discussion was really started, that was the Alberta government that provided the money. The Alberta government, although they didn't participate in the Phase 1 Alaska-Canada Rail Link study, were involved. The Van Horn Institute at the University of Calgary was part of one of our partners on that 2007 study, and they're actually the entity that's managing that $1.8 million that the Alberta government put forward for the oil sands feasibility study.
Well, they're actually, they approached us at Penwar last time and are really trying to push something right now. And so it's still something that they are very interested in.
That's correct. We have a small portion of that contract, as Representative Isaacs mentioned.
Okay. Well, any other questions from anyone? I guess you'll have to start working on your bill and see if you can get enough support so that we can bring it up again. So next, this coming Thursday, we will have a joint meeting with the Senate, and that's going to be on the big mega projects, the Ambler Road and the Juneau Access Road, I think those two. So that will be coming up on Thursday. So until then, we will, I think we start at 1:30 that day?
No, 1.
1? Okay. All right, so then we'll see you at 1 on Thursday, and this meeting is adjourned.